Welcome to episode 9 of season 3 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard Di Gregorio.
And I'm sports watcher Greg Ralph. No, I can't even say that with a straight face. I am so not a sports watcher.
Well, this is why we've chosen to do a sports day episode.
So this is like you making me watch horror films.
Yeah, that's right. Of course. I mean, I love sports films. I think that, you know, I always get...
Well, you're a sports person, I'm not.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, this is why it's good, you know. So we've chosen 3 films to talk about with sports-related themes. So we've got 2009's The Blind Side.
And then we have an Australian film called The Merger, made in 2018.
And then we have 1989's Field of Dreams.
And the saving grace is that I managed to distract you from choosing Rocky, which I've still seen.
Weird. I can't believe I didn't think about that one.
I'm very happy.
Later episode.
We have talked about Mr. Stallone before.
Very true. So, all right, then let's kick off proceedings. Let's talk about The Blind Side.
Okay. So Michael Orr is a professional American gridiron player. He had a rough start in life, born to a mother with addiction problems and a father who was typically in jail and eventually murdered there. As a result, his early years were a mixture of foster care and homelessness, while attending 11 schools in his first 9 years as a student. This 2009 film tells the story of how 17-year-old Michael joins a prestigious Christian school and then finds a supportive community. He's found walking the streets in the rain by interior designer Leanne Tui, who invites him to stay in their family home. Leanne is a powerhouse who gets Michael on track for his education, then as a tackling footballer, because she links this to his strong instinct to protect those he cares about. And eventually their family adopts Michael. Leanne is played by Sandra Bullock in a multi-award-winning performance, including the Oscar. Her dynamic yet diminutive white figure stands in stark contrast to, but in close companionship with, her tall, hulking black son, as celebrated on the movie's poster. It's a great part for her to sink her teeth into, and you can see why she won the awards. She's given light and shade to work with. She's a full-on extrovert with seemingly endless energy to effortlessly combine family, household, work and school involvement. But she needs to withdraw when experiencing strong emotions, such as when she realises that Michael has never owned a bed before. I believe her. Michael is a more problematic character, imposing in physique but with very little to say. Quentin Aaron does what he can with the script, communicating through subtle facial expression rather than words in his first major role, and he doesn't have a lot to do. I understand that the real-life Michael Orr isn't happy with this film's representation of his life, showing him as sad, introverted, and a complete novice at the game when the opposites were true. But the real story behind this film is highly inspirational, and the film moves many people, including my 2 sons. And there were moments when it did move me, partly through knowing it's based on a real person's experiences. But this film didn't work for me as story. It's quite predictable, even down to an impending car accident, tapping into a pet peeve of mine about movies, which is why won't characters watch the road when they're driving? And later, when the climax event comes, it feels like a minor moment. Many of the characters feel like stereotypes across racial groups, leaving me uncomfortable. Key characters feel passive, particularly Michael himself and his adoptive father, Sean, country and western star Tim McGraw. Kathy Bates, as Michael's tutor, feels tokenistic. Other characters bob up in the narrative, only for the story to lose interest in them. Big Tony's son, who enrolls at the same school as Michael, Michael's teachers, and his birth mother and brother that we briefly encounter. In this film, sport is an avenue for social and economic improvement. I feel that I understand gridiron better, particularly in terms of the protector role, but I don't feel that I've learned what people see in the game or get out of it, other than tribal loyalty to your alma mater and something to watch while eating. Perhaps that's it. Ricardo, what did you think?
Look, it's a good story. Okay, it's a true story. So every time there is a true story, I like it because it is. You know, I'm thinking this happened. But you're right. You're talking about passive characters. The film is very passive.
The story is almost by numbers.
It is by numbers, and look, it's easy to watch, and it's just very simple. It was okay. Okay, it was light on. It doesn't go really hard with pretty hard subject matter.
Well,
his past is tragic. We don't ever go there. We hardly see it in its brief little flashbacks, which I feel like it could have just gone harder a little bit, you know. You know, if they call it the blind side, they really kept it on the light side.
Well, yes.
You know, and I felt like we could have... He was so quiet throughout this whole film.
Yes. Apparently he's not actually like that.
Well, that's a weird choice then. It's a weird choice. And when I heard you say that, I thought that is a weird choice to go down because really I found it very difficult to watch him and really understand him because they didn't even give us a lot of flashbacks. So I couldn't really get the feelings he had inside. He was introverted, but usually with a flashback, we want to learn why he's introverted. I hardly knew why. And even his mother didn't seem that bad, you know?
No, but she got better.
I know she got better, but the thing is, but even the brother. Like, this is another real irk of mine because he goes inside to this restaurant, sees this guy, hugs him.
And he was working as the table cleaner.
As the table cleaner. Yeah. Then Sandra Bullock asks, "Who was that?" "That was my brother. I haven't seen since I was a young boy." We never see him again.
Well, but also she doesn't want to meet him. She doesn't say bring him home, does she even? Like, it's just like,
Avatar. She doesn't. But that's his brother.
I know.
They hugged.
It's that passivity.
They hugged, Greg.
I know, without saying much, I know.
And then they don't see each other again.
I know.
Weird.
But the story also, from what I understand, compared to the real life story, the adjustment of Michael coming into Vatui's home and becoming part of the family and even the ongoing relationship with his two adoptive parents have been rocky roads. Apparently he's closer to the two siblings, is what I read. So there's actually a story that... This story is too smooth.
Way too smooth.
Passive and smooth.
The main gripe I've got with it is that Sandra Bullock's character is so good. By the way, she's very, very good.
She
okay?
is.
She makes the film. If it wasn't for her, my God, it would fall flat.
Yes.
Right? She really lifts it. She's... That performance... It is her film. Mm. And, you know, any kudos that the reviewers
give for this movie...
Which
makes Michael incidental in his own life story.
Yeah.
But you're right,
yeah.
You're spot on.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt like she just brought him in so quickly.
Well, she didn't in real life. Like, they met on the street. It wasn't raining. They met on the street.
Well, that's Hollywoodization. That's okay.
But they met a couple of times. Then she went to, by accident, then she found him at the school. Then she took him on the shopping trip. So they were telescoping, but it is quick.
It's so quick. But then she's like, come and have the bed. Come with it. It's like she, I just don't know. I couldn't get the...
But then the weird thing was, they're obviously an incredibly wealthy family.
Oh, my goodness.
The size of the house and the gardens.
The car they buy him straight away.
I know. Brand new SUV.
SUV.
Truck.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when they're accused of making big donations to the college.
That's right.
So obviously very, very wealthy. Mm. She invites him home in this huge house. There's the couch. Like, there is a spare room which is overloaded with her boxes and stuff because she's this interior designer. But that's all there was, just the couch in the front room.
But she did say that you ruined my $10,000 couch.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a good story. And it was interesting because at the end of the film you get to see Michael Orr getting drafted.
Yep.
In the 2009 draft. Now, this movie came out in 2009, so they must have just, like, finished the film. He got drafted and just chucked it at the end. Like I said, it's an enjoyable film. I did like it when I was watching it. I did get some feels in it. But, again, it's just too light and too, again, a bit overly sentimental.
Well, there's criticism made of this film, too, that it can be read as a film about a white saviour.
Mm.
Like, he is so passive in his own life story. And she comes in and she rescues him.
Yeah.
And she stands up to her white, you know, country club ladies who lunch friends. And he stands up to his no hope, ghetto, drugs all around, you know, friends. So they feel like stereotypes. Like, there's nothing interesting in terms of character.
One of the best moments of the film.
Which?
When he stands up to those guys.
I thought you were going to say when she stood up to her friends over lunch.
Oh, they're both good moments.
No, they are both
good moments. Well, at least, you know what I liked about Michael Orr's moment? He was doing something.
Well, yes, okay.
It's way too passive, way too...
I think there's actually a really interesting and really inspirational story behind this film.
Yeah.
But this film doesn't quite get there.
And I got it. It doesn't quite get to the extent you want it to, but it still does it. I mean, it's not a
a bad, bad, bad film, but
I bought into it at the start.
It's safe. It's very safe.
Yes, I bought it into the start and I thought, okay, it's a sports film, but I think I'm going to enjoy this. But I was expecting Michael to blossom.
Mm.
And he had that one particularly dedicated teacher, played by, I think it's Kim Wilkes.
Yeah. She was great. She was good.
It was a good performance. So I thought they're going to realise he learns a different kind of way. He's going to blossom. And he kind of blossomed in terms of footy. Sorry, gridiron.
Yeah.
But that was it.
Well, when he was getting his marks up, when they got the tutor, I could see via the paper they were circling a B+, they were circling an A, but I couldn't see it in the performance.
And I have to say, that's maybe it was true in real life, but the scene when the adoptive father, Sean, gets him interested into the Valley of Death poem.
That was actually quite... It was an okay moment. I didn't mind his performance either.
I couldn't see... given how he hadn't responded to more academic stuff all the way through, the fact that was a bit of an archaic poem where Sean, the dad, explains what it means and relates to football and he gets it, but then he absolutely runs with it. I didn't feel that.
Yeah.
What did you think of the son?
I really liked him, actually. Right. It was a good performance, actually. The car moment when they had an accident... Come on, it's one of the most heavily used devices in film. And when he got in the car...
Again, it could be true, but it was telegraphed so big. But
it was very big and for dramatic effect, you know. And also, I found her pretty blasé about it. He's all right, don't worry about it, it's okay. You know, the father didn't do anything, didn't say anything. You know, here's this guy's come into their lives and nearly killed their son.
And written off the new car.
And written off the new...
Well, obviously very wealthy.
I know, but they start that scene with her saying, the insurance is fine, it's fine. You know, he's nearly killed your son. And you just, it's okay, don't worry about it. It's okay. He's all right, you're fine. I don't know. I would be pissed off. I don't know, I'd be pretty upset.
Well, maybe she was feeling guilty about the fact that she let her son go in the front seat when he obviously wasn't supposed to.
I know. Yeah. I don't know.
So what are you giving this film?
I'm giving it a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
6 out of 10. You obviously enjoyed it on the way through more than I did.
I did.
Like, I started to and then it lost me.
The thing is, I think when I was watching it, at the end of the film, I was thinking of it more of a 7, but it was just afterwards I got thinking about it and I thought... You know what? No.
You make it sound like the filmic equivalent of that, you know, stereotypical Chinese meal. Like it fills you for the moment and it kind of wears off really quickly.
Yeah, it did. And it shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Because it is a good story. I just thought it was played very safe.
Behind the script, there's a good story.
Yeah, that's right.
So when we were choosing sports films for this episode, we wanted to represent the home team. So, Ricardo, why don't you tell us about the Australian rules footy film, The Merger?
Released in 2018, the comedy The Merger was directed by Mark Grentel, who previously made 2013's Backyard Ashes. And it was written by actor-comedian Damien Callinan, who wrote this film based on his successful live one-man show. The Merger tells the story of a retired AFL footballer, Troy Carrington, Callinan, who was once loved by all in the struggling town of Bodgy Creek. But after injuring himself badly running through the crepe paper banner on grand final day and then supporting the closure of a local mill, he's now known to many as Town Killer. When the town's struggling footy team has the possibility of merging with another team, due to being left without a base due to asbestos, a coach due to health, and a full team due to dwindling numbers, the town have no choice but to ask Troy Carrington to help them out by putting together a footy team and coaching them. He is persuaded by recently widowed mother Angie, Kate Mulvaney, and her aspiring filmmaker son Neil, Rafferty Grierson, who begins making a documentary on Troy. The team he brings together are a multicultural bunch, which includes a Syrian refugee, Sayed Faisal Abazi, who found a love for AFL while detained on his way to Australia. Angie's racist father-in-law, though, John Howard, opposes Troy's team and is against the efforts to integrate asylum seekers into the town. Look, there's no surprises here with how the footy team goes. This is, after all, a feel-good film which has a lot of heart, and from hearing other thoughts on the film, I know I'm not the only one to say that. It's less about the footy merger and more about the merging of different cultures and the issues that forever arise with new migration. I feel the film does lay this on too thick for my liking, though, but using sport to raise these issues is smart as it brings people together. There are some moments also, such as Angie watching footage of Neil and Troy bonding together and talking about death, which are really touching. In fact, the romance between Troy and Angie is a highlight. There are so many characters in this, and they all play their quirky part. The performances are all very solid. I really like Callanan. I've liked him ever since his television days in Skid House in the early 2000s. And again, he's great here. Kate Mulvaney is also very delightful, and I also liked her in another film, which was called The Little Death. Director Mark Rentel does a fine job of weaving all these lovable characters together to make you care about them. The film is well shot and captured the beauty of the Australian country. However, I felt some scenes could have been edited a little more, being a bit too long. Some jokes work, some jokes don't. But really, you don't care. This is very easy to watch with a good message and a feel-good ending. It does have a heart, and that's more than I can say for many films. Greg, what did you think of it?
I was really aligned with you all the way through there until almost at the end. I don't think this film is well shot. I found the camera work deeply frustrating. In which way? I just felt there were too many static, long or medium shots of people, particularly in the first half of the film, mm-hmm. when I really wanted to be able to see the characters better. And you haven't mentioned yet Penny Cook. So Penny Cook plays...
This is a minor role, so yeah.
That's part of my problem.
Yeah.
Penny Cook, who plays the mother-in-law,
she's
Fran,
very good as well. Yeah.
Is a wonderful actor, a much-loved actor here over the last 30, 40 years, and who sadly died very young, not long after this film was completed.
That's right.
So I love watching Penny Cook. I wanted to see more of her, and it was through the fact that I could almost never see her face that I suddenly became attuned to the fact that a lot of the camera work really was not coming in on people.
Mm.
And I don't know if this is meant to be clever to show the distance between people, but it was happening with people within families. And Penny Cook only had one really good moment in the film.
Yes.
And a very quick burst of a scene where she... is saying to her husband, "Don't you dare say that I don't miss our son.
Yeah, that's
I miss him every second of the day."
Yeah, it's a beautiful
and it's one. Heartfelt and it's totally believable. And you get a great close-up of her there. And then you get one or two during the final game in the grand final and not much else. And I just found in a lot of the film, the camera actually wasn't engaging the characters. It happened more inside the footy tent,
mm-hmm.
maybe because there wasn't much room to do anything mm-hmm. else. But no, I was not a fan of the camera work on this film at all. I do agree with you that using sport for this message was very smart. Mm. I think using the small country town as a microcosm of Australian society made perfect sense.
Yes, it does.
And what you started to allude to was that this is a story that we do need to tell in Australia.
Yeah, we do.
And what I liked about the story is, as you use the word heart a few times in your introduction, this film is very much about heart.
It is.
And that heart is completely in the right place.
It does shine through.
In looking at racism, fear, segregation, even
absolutely.
The fact that Troy is an outsider to start with.
Yeah, that's right.
And he actually merges not only himself but these other people who are outsiders, certainly some people in the town in particular, merges them into the community through what he does, not just in the playing of sport, but the way he makes the different team members, the local Anglo-Aussies and the more recent arrivals, integrate, understand each other's stories and pet hates, pet loves, silly behaviours and so on.
Well, it's interesting what they did there because they made the ultra-racist guy carpet burn.
Yep.
The outsider at the end.
Yes.
So that was quite a good full circle in the story.
Well, the thing I just wanted to pick up from what I was saying is that I think what this story does is say something about the flip side of that racism and segregation that we're tarred with at the moment. And that is that Australians, I don't want to be too rose-coloured glass here, but I think Australians have been better at accepting people who were deemed as other once they actually got to know them as people. So I'm thinking sort of from the 70s onwards, certainly in terms of my life, that they were other. There was certainly racist stuff that went on. But once people got to know people, it's never perfect, but things worked better, and then there'd be a new wave and there'd be the same stuff going on.
It's all the same. It's all the same. It's the same pattern and cycle which keeps happening over generation to generation of new immigrants. It's the same pattern.
Look, I think you're spot on. However, I'm not the biggest fan of this film. I wish I was. I really want to like it. But I wish this film was better. So you talked about it being funny and hit and miss. Look, there were funny elements, but a lot of it fell flat. I wondered how much would really make sense overseas.
Oh, look, it's going to be hard to find a market outside of Australia, I think, because it's so Australian. It's like the castle would be very difficult to work outside of Australia.
Which we've got to talk about one day too.
Yeah, we should.
I suspect this probably worked better on stage, in terms of humour at least.
Yeah, well, I think he's always very good on stage.
I've already told you what I thought about the camera work and how frustrated I got with that. I think the film actually skates across story elements. So we hear about the closure of the mill. We hear that's why Troy's called Town Killer, ha-ha. And then it's not touched on again and about the impact and maybe how they got past that, if at all. There's a really big issue here, which is that Troy actually is replacing the dead son. You know exactly why that matters to Bull. You can be really proud of Fran that she can see past that. But it's an issue. And in fact, the dead dad, the son Neil uses the camera that his dad gave him at his last Christmas.
That's right.
He doesn't take off the onesie rooster outfit that his dad gave him. But you don't actually get beyond that a deep sense of connection with the son or the fact that there might be issues about Troy coming into this space. I just felt like that part of the story was skated across and everyone else just kind of moved on from it. And I
didn't have that much of an issue with that, to tell you the truth.
No,
I got it because I know, look, it had only been a year.
It was a sudden death. It was a motorbike accident on the farm. It wasn't like he died slowly kind of thing.
No.
So they all had a big shock. And I understood there was a very good line when there's a moment between Angie and Troy when she says to him, do you know how hard it is to want to date someone in a small town surrounded by your dead husband's mates?
Yeah.
And I totally got that.
Yeah.
And that rang true.
Yeah.
But there was just, I just felt like it really was
more.
Too over the surface. I didn't want to dwell on it, but I just didn't feel that they felt it particularly. It was more that the story said that they felt it.
Maybe we thought the parents felt it more than Angie.
Yes, yeah. And I have to say, look, the best moment I got out of this film was before I started watching it. I was...
Oh, Greg. Really? Come on.
I was... look,
jeepers.
Look, we've already said that I'm not a sports person.
I know.
I come from a family which are pretty sports keen. I have a son who is a sports nut. My family thinks that's the biggest cosmic joke of all time. Now, I spoke to my dad just before I started the film and I said, I have to go now. I have to watch an AFL footy film. And that just tickled him. He laughed uproariously as he harped. And I felt that like kind of shared humour about it because he knows I just don't understand or value our national game. But what this film does do is... get over it. Just because your team keeps losing. Even I, who know nothing about Aussie rules, knows that Carlton is in the poo. Anyway.
16 premierships, Greg. 16 premierships.
I don't know what that means. Is that good? I've got
yes,
no idea.
Yes, it is. The best in the league.
And how long ago were they?
95 was our last.
That was this millennium? No, last millennium. Okay, all right.
Still... See, wasn't long ago.
But look, for those who aren't from Melbourne or Australia, look, AFL footy is deeply, deeply ingrained in our local culture. Yeah. Even I, who don't care about the slightest, cannot escape
Victorian
knowing some
state
things.
Culture.
Well, this film was set in New South Wales. Do New South Wales country towns have Aussie rules teams? I would have thought it would be rugby or something.
Rugby's more prominent in New South Wales and Queensland.
In big cities, in country towns? I don't know. I found that interesting.
Yeah.
But I did feel it was... that this film does give a good sense of why that small town footy club matters in the country town and why it becomes a good epicenter for this story it's telling. And there were parts of the film that I did find genuinely moving, particularly that there were things around loss. And for me, the highlight of it was that very, very short scene with Penny Cook as Fran, the mother-in-law who'd lost her adult son. Mm. You know, I actually think this film criminally underuses Penny Cook. I think she could have been so much stronger in this, and to say her last film and we've lost her. And I surprised myself. I did feel emotional when they kicked the final goal in the grand final. And Dad, if you're listening, I hope you're very happy that I've said that once in my life. I was excited by an Aussie rules footy goal. It's going to be the only time, mind you. It was a great message, and I think it could have been so much more, had more potential. I just wish that the script had gone through a few more review cycles before they started making the film.
What did you think of, I mean, it was a big part of the story, which was Saeed's character.
Yeah, that was great, and he was very good in the part.
He was very good in the part, but I still think it was laboured when they were sitting in. He did his speech about what happened to him in his apartment, in his house he was staying in. It was just like one shot. It was like a wide. It didn't really cut off that a lot. And
at that point, I was listening to the story, and I thought that rang true. And I've heard a little of refugee stories, and I thought it was great. It was in for me that part actually worked.
I just thought it went a little bit long, that's all. Yeah.
I just think that with a bit more discipline in the script writing and maybe the editing and certainly the bloody camera work, I think this could actually...
We're
going to disagree on this. I think this film really had the potential to be a lasting classic for Australia that had a really strong... positive set of messages grounded in real life.
Well, that still does,
life.
Though. It does have a good positive set of messages.
No, it does, and that's why I'm almost a bit angry with this film, because I think it could have been so much more. I think it's going to be too flash in the pan because the craftsmanship wasn't strong enough.
Oh, I think that's being a bit harsh on it. I think it labours it on very well in terms of the themes in it. Did you get emotional at all when she was watching the footage of them together and communicating about death?
No, not at all.
That was one bit which got me a lot, because the boy was connecting with someone who could be his father figure, and he was searching for another father figure. I thought that was really lovely.
I was
moved by that. That's one thing when I say this film's got heart. I wouldn't say it's got heart. I wasn't moved by it.
I didn't entirely believe the son's performance.
I did.
Yeah, I know. You and I are not going to agree on this film. Well, we're going to agree in parts.
Yeah.
In terms of the story, the strength of the story, the value of the story.
Yeah.
We're not going to agree on some of the technical elements of it. That's quite clear.
Yeah.
So what are you giving it?
I'm giving it a 7.
I'm giving it a 6.
Okay.
I wondered if I should take it down a bit just to emphasise the contrast.
You paused it.
But no, I thought it was a 6, and I think it's a 6. So, yeah, I just think it could have been a lot more, and I really wish it had been a lot more. I think it's a great message. It's a great one to have out in the Australian market.
Absolutely.
I think it's an easier pill to swallow because of the Australian larrikin kind of elements around it.
I think this is a really good family film because, you know, there is some great messages in there.
Look, I agree. I just think it could have been more.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. And now for our final Sports Day film, it's Field of Dreams. Take it away, Greg.
Well, I have to say, I feel a bit intimidated at having to capture the spirit of this 1989 film, because I loved it when I first saw it way back then. So much so that I went and bought the book, and I cannot tell you how extraordinary that is for me when it comes to sport. But let me say now, the true purpose of our Sports Day episode is actually to give me an excuse to rave about this film with Ricardo. It's not the other two films, this is the one. Ray Kinsella, Kevin Costner, is a survivor of the 60s who moves with his wife Annie, Amy Madigan, to her home state Iowa to become a corn farmer. He has no family ties to bind him. His father was a much older man who raised him when his mother died young, and they had a difficult relationship which wasn't resolved at his father's death. The only legacy was a love of baseball, although his father's worship of Shoeless Joe Jackson, an early 20th century baseball player whose career was ruined by a betting scandal, became something that Ray used against his father, and it's a deep regret for him that he never apologised to his dad while he was still alive. One beautiful summer's twilight, Ray is out in his cornfield when he hears a voice whispering, "If you build it, he will come." Now, Ray has no idea what the "it" or "he" refers to, but eventually he has a vision that he is to plough under part of his crop to build a baseball field as a way of reclaiming the reputation of his father's hero, Shoeless Joe, Ray Liotta. He does this and then gradually receives more messages so that he goes on a baseball-inspired road quest. He's joined by reclusive 60s literary icon Terence Mann, played by James Earl Jones, and an elderly small-town doctor, Burt Lancaster, in a marvellous end-of-career performance. All the while, economic forces are gathering that risk the little family losing their farm, led by Annie's brother Mark, Timothy Busfield. Terence Mann's character is powerfully drawn and completely believable as the author of a landmark 60s novel who then dropped out of sight. So much so that I convinced myself that he was based on the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, only to learn through W.P. Kinsella's novel that he was originally based on J.D. Salinger, author of Catcher in the Rye, who threatened to sue if the film character was shown as him. James Earl Jones was convinced to take the part because of a wonderful speech he gives towards the end of the film that lyrically captures the essence of the love for and almost biblical mythology of baseball. Now, I can't do this in James Earl Jones' marvellous voice, but things like, "People will come, Ray. They'll come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom. They'll arrive at your door as innocent as children longing for the past. They'll pass over the money without even thinking about it, for it is money they have and peace they lack. And they'll watch the game, and it'll be as if they dipped themselves in magic waters. The memories will be so thick they'll have to brush them away from their faces. This field, this game, it's a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good and could be good again." And the novelist is not the only one who pays testament to the simple joys of the game and the enduring power of a father and son playing catch with a baseball. Throughout, there are characters who can and those who can't see the spirits of the players who come to play ball again. It very much depends on their own spirit, their openness to the simple joys of the game. Like the South Korean film that we reviewed in our last episode, 1987, When the Day Comes, Field of Dreams gives me an entry point into a hitherto unknown world. There's a depth to this beautifully filmed story. Even though this is definitely a film about men, Annie is a funny and feisty standout character who passionately believes in the artistic freedom and countercultural vision of the 60s. And there are little touches that reward repeat viewing. For example, on this, my fourth or fifth time, I notice that Ray's visit to the local feed store after he's ploughed under his crop is accompanied by a radio playing in the background Patsy Cline's country classic, Crazy. You'll like this film or you won't, just as you'd see the baseball players or not. You'll be emotionally touched or you'll find it corny and sentimental. And yes, the corn reference is deliberate. So, Ricardo, did this film hit a home run with you?
Can you just think of the pitch for this movie?
Literally, the pitch?
When it was coming up. It's a movie about a guy hearing voices in a cornfield. There's magic, time travel, and ghost baseball players. Mix it in with a father-son story. It's going to be amazing. This really shouldn't work. It really shouldn't.
And I don't know if it can be made now, actually.
Probably not. It asks us to fully suspend our disbelief.
Oh, yeah.
But we just do. We just go with it. I was taken by the trailer of this film when it came out in 89. I remember the trailer. And just the, if you build it, it will come bit. And I always felt it was always such a mystery. And I remember when I first watched it years ago, I loved it. Okay, I haven't seen this film in a long time. So revisiting it again is quite interesting. I didn't love it as much as I did back then. It does ask you to really suspend your disbelief a lot. I mean, you really, this guy would seem like he was crazy.
While being grounded in reality.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of commentary about this film, and I totally get this, but this is the kind of film that in the 80s Frank Capra would have made.
Mm.
And in fact, they didn't have Burt Lancaster as their first choice for the small town country doctor.
Mm.
They had Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart knocked it back. He didn't like the idea of playing someone who had, well, spoil it a little bit, who had died and come back. So he knocked it back. He would have been perfect in this. And there's a little reference to him in Harvey, which I'm pretty sure is a Frank Capra film, when the daughter is watching it on TV at one point.
And he
is saying to you, this is Capra-like, basically.
Yeah.
It so is.
Yeah, it is.
It's whimsy and magic in the middle of the everyday.
It asks you to go with it, but then it keeps asking you to go further and further along, and then suddenly He's with Burt Lancaster and he's time traveled. It just keeps going.
And it's
back.
Done so subtly.
It is done subtly.
He's walking down the street at night in the town and he starts realizing that there's posters for Nixon on the wall.
That's right.
The local theatre is showing the first release of The Godfather. Yeah. It just happens.
Look, it's very well written in that way. It's very hard to do that, to seamlessly do that. Technically, it's marvellous. I mean, there's great lines in here. I mean, really, the whisper and everything. But, you know, one thing I really love about this film is the sound design. I think the sound design was beautifully done and it is one of the real reasons as to why the mystery works in the beginning. Now, the first 10 minutes of this film is very important because if you're not going to get taken up by that sound of the whispering, it's... or the voice, and you're going to go with it, you're gone.
That's not the start of the film. The start of the film is him telling his backstory about his dad.
Oh, yeah. I think that...
Which I actually missed the very start or the first time I saw it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, still was totally into it.
Yeah, I think that goes on a bit. It really does. It goes on for quite a long time.
It's laying the groundwork.
But I know, but it does it. I mean, it's just... I'm going to tell you everything about this and then we're going to make it work. I don't know. It just goes on for a while. That's okay. And it's Kevin Costner delivering it. Kevin Costner's very good. I really like Kevin Costner. So it's easy. But it's really important. That sound is on. The wind. The wind. There's that whisper of
and
wind.
And just the way that when the baseball players go back, just kind of merge into the cornfield with just the sound, the wind and the rustling.
That's right.
No special effects.
Hardly any really basic special effects, but it just works. They've done it beautifully well.
Well, they were offered special effects, like, you know, golden shimmery outlines.
No.
And they knocked it back, I think for budgetary reasons, but that would now look so dated.
It would.
And this doesn't.
This doesn't at all. So it doesn't date, it hasn't dated that much, this film,
No, not
film,
at all. It's
right?
30 years.
It's 30 years. And one of the, I thought was a masterstroke in casting was casting Burt Lancaster because at the time it was a nostalgic feel to see Burt Lancaster there in the role. But now, even 30 years later, it still works because it's Burt Lancaster.
He's a very mannered performer.
Yeah.
And I think he borders on overacting. But
a little bit.
But he's meant to be this character from another time, so
that's
I think that works.
Yeah. And, I mean, I always liked Frank Whaley as well. He played the younger version.
Yes.
I really like Frank Whaley in a lot of stuff as well. But, yeah, the sound design was great. Because, you know, people would think it was the score. James Horner did a really lovely score to the film as well. But I think the sound design was
great.
The
cinematography is beautiful.
Cinematography is gorgeous.
Particularly around the farm.
Yeah, gorgeous. Yeah. Very, very gorgeous.
The light.
But you're right, I think. Either you're going to go with it or you're not. I think if you're not taken within the first 15 minutes of this, and it really sets it up well, it really cuts to the chase and gets to it straight away. If you're not taken with it, you'll be lost because it asks you to go further and further. And you're thinking to yourself a lot of the time, people would really think he's gone nuts.
Oh, yeah. And he's not from farming stock.
No.
So there's a few comments about the fact that, you know, he was never meant to be a farmer.
Yeah.
And he doesn't realise that he's actually sabotaging himself. And yet he just trots out the figure of I think it was $200 or $2,200 an acre. He knows his stuff, but everyone's prepared to believe he doesn't.
What I like about the film, and I think, you know, from this angle, is that he doesn't want to let go of his past, obviously his father.
Yeah.
But also the love of baseball, that feeling of when he was a young kid. He doesn't want to let go of his child self. He's too scared
of
growing up.
It's about mythology.
Yes.
It's about nostalgia. It's about second chances to resolve lifelong regrets.
Yep.
I mean, there's actually a lot of substance to this fable.
Let's talk about Ray Liotta. Now, I know there's
Let's talk about Ray Liotta.
Yeah. I know some people can't get past him playing Henry Hill in Goodfellas, right, and feel like this was just before Goodfellas, actually, he made this, because Goodfellas came out in 1990. That's a tough role. They're not doing any sort of effects on him. He's a ghost. And you have to believe in the mystery of that character. And, geez, he does it well. When he looks over, and I believe he has come from the afterlife. I really do.
Yeah.
And his silences, his looks. That is a very, very tough performance and very good performance.
Well, I haven't seen Goodfellas. Mm. This was the
He's
first...
very good in that as well.
Well, that's probably why it's called Goodfellas. Yeah. But this is the first film I ever saw him in, and I was very taken with his performance.
Yeah, it's very
Such
good.
That anything he's been in since, good or bad, I carry a lot of sentiment for him because I love them so much in this film that I love so much. The Annie character, she's really strong at the start.
I love her.
She sort of falls away, and that's because of the nature of the narrative arc.
Of the story, yeah.
But she gets some great lines too, like some really funny lines.
I loved it when she just...
Has the breakdown at the PTA meeting?
Yeah, when she has the breakdown at the PTA meeting when she...
Not just, breakdown, she just lets go.
Well, she lets go and just lets that woman have it. But I love that.
That says, yeah, that great line. I wrote it down.
Yeah.
When the other one says, what, you think I didn't have the 60s? She says, no, I think you had 250s and moved right on to the 70s.
Yeah, that's right. It's that's a great line. It's a very good line. I love that when she busts out, she finishes, they walk out.
And she's still full of energy. She's still full of energy. She slides out like Tom Cruise in Risky Business.
He gives her nothing at all, right, to say, well done. You did such a great job. He's so in his own world. I felt they could...
But then she'll swing out of it and come back to what he's doing.
Yeah.
And she is unbelievably supportive. Like,
she is.
In a way you think, well, but they happen in real life.
He could have given her a little bit more support there.
But, well, yes. But she gets some sarky lines as well. Yeah. Sorry, sarcastic lines. Like at one stage she says to him about Terrence Mann, oh, as a boy he had a bat named Rosebud. Like, that line is just spot on. It's so incisive about what's going on and about the sentiment and the mythos and so on. But she totally goes with it. It's just a pity she's not there for more of it. But she is so good in the part.
She's very good in the part.
Now, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
The voice that you hear a few times in the cornfields and elsewhere, which actor is that?
The credits say himself.
Yeah, who is it?
I don't know.
Do you want me to tell you?
Yes, please.
Nobody knows. No. The rumours are that it might be Kevin Costner, that it might be Ed Harris, who was married to Amy Madigan. So we've been floating around.
Okay.
But it's a kept secret.
Oh, wow.
No one actually knows who it is. And yet, towards the end, James Earl Jones' character, the novelist Terrence Mann, says, I think, to Ray Kinsella, it was you. It was you calling us to do all these things. So to me, it would make sense for that voice to actually be Kevin Costner.
Or the father.
No, because...
No, I know.
Based on what Terrence Mann said,
yeah, okay.
I would like it to be Kevin Costner.
I can't hear the tonality of Kevin Costner in that voice at all.
I mean, that line, that situation that caught your attention in the trailer of just this voice in the cornfield just saying,
beautiful.
Build it and he will come. Which apparently a lot of people misremember and are quite defiant in their misremembering that it's build it and they will come. But it's build it and he will come. That line became iconic in the 90s. That was the line that people used for e-commerce. You know, if you build the website, they will come. Like, it was all that kind of innocence of build the website and people just turn up to it. Now, we know better than that these days.
Yes.
But that line really, really took hold because it captured people's imagination.
Oh, ease his pain, go the distance.
Yeah.
But even people will come, Ray.
Well, that speech I quoted
is
such a great speech. And, you know, James Earl Jones is perfect to deliver it.
The end, when after he says all that, it's nighttime and then all the cars are coming there in the last shot of the movie.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe a little bit far-fetched. How do they know? And then...
Oh, so you didn't suspend your disbelief. I'm sorry. I thought you said
I did. But like I tell you, it really pushes you to go there. And then suddenly when you do suspend your disbelief and then you're seeing it as a real story and then suddenly it pushes you again to suspend your disbelief.
Do you know how they filmed that scene?
No, I don't know. They probably did it in some post. I don't know.
They blacked out the town, the local town of Dyersville in Iowa.
Yeah,
they got 3,000 locals.
Are you serious? Yeah, they did it in camera?
Yeah, in 1,500 cars. They coordinated them all through the local radio station, so they knew what to do. They got them driving down the road, and they got the drivers to flash their high beams on and off as they drove to give that sense of movement to the lights. It was spot on. It was a great ending to the film.
But you know, I can't believe they did that in camera. That is fantastic.
Well, I have some trivia about this film. So I've already told you that Jimmy Stewart was who they originally wanted to play the part of Doc Graham that Burt Lancaster did. Do you know who were extras in the PTA scene? Well, actually, there were two pairs. One was the novelist Kinsella and his wife were there.
Oh, really?
But the other two, who never made it onto screen, were a very young Ben Affleck and Matt Damon.
Are you serious?
In that scene, yes.
No way.
Such that when Ben Affleck later worked with Phil Alden Robinson, the director, on I think it might have been The Summer of All Fears, when he turned up, he went to Robinson and said, it's great to be working for you again. And of course, Robin looks blankly and said, I was an extra who never made it on screen in that scene. But the other one, which I really love, is that...
Do you see them?
No, they don't make it. They were cut. They were there, but they were cut.
Yeah.
So the book was called Shoeless Joe.
Yes.
And Alden Robinson, who was the director and the writer, the screenwriter, called the film Shoeless Joe. And when they got down to that final test, and they do with, you know, test audiences, the title wasn't testing well, and the producers were concerned that the title Shoeless Joe made it sound like it was a film about a homeless man, and that wouldn't sell.
Yeah.
So in the end, they forced the title of Field of Dreams onto Robinson, who didn't like it. And so he picked up the phone and he rang Kinsella, who wrote the novel, and said, I'm really sorry. I promised I'd protect your property and stay true to the spirit as best I can, but I'm now having this new title pushed onto me. And Kinsella said, well, what's the title? He said, Field of Dreams. He said, oh, actually, I didn't want to call my novel Shoeless Joe. The publishers forced it on me. Robinson said, well, what did you want to call it? And he said, The Dream Field.
Oh, my goodness.
So the whole thing went full circle.
Wow, that is a fantastic story.
I've already told you, I love this film, and I love all those stories around it. So where are you going to rate this?
It is a bit of a classic. It's not, you know, it is. I'm giving it an 8 out of 10. I really like it.
In the spirit of Sports Day, hiss, boo!
No,
not good enough.
I'm giving it an 8
out of 10. Play higher, play higher.
No, come on.
The movie. I can't believe I said that.
8 out of 10 is quite high. It is a bit of a classic. We couldn't go lower than that, but an 8 out of 10.
Well, I'm giving it a 10.
10?
You said earlier...
Oh, my goodness. It's not It's a Wonderful Life territory.
I'm sorry. It's really up there for me. And, you know,
10?
I'm a sucker for Capra kind of films. But
There's some really...
You said earlier that you didn't know how you would feel watching this film all these years later.
Yeah.
Now, say it's the fourth or fifth time for me, but it's been a while since I've seen it.
Yeah.
And I was completely emotionally engaged again. I felt teary at the emotional high points.
I don't get that emotional.
This film is a mystery to me in some ways because it's a sports film, and I am not a sports person, as I've said repeatedly, not only in this podcast but throughout my life.
Can I ask you?
But yeah, it's because it hits the notes and it really taps into that mythology of fathers and sons and second chances. Well, and it just gets me.
Yeah, well, that father-son aspect of the film really got to me. I really felt emotional about those moments. But let me ask you a question. Now, you love this film. You've given it a 10 out of 10.
Mm.
Hits you in there. Do you get into baseball at all?
I am actually more conducive to baseball than any other sport because of this film.
Wow.
It really, like I said, like the...
Would you watch a game?
I have watched bits of a game. You don't get much access here in Australia.
Yeah.
I have.
But, yeah, would you like to go see one in there?
Yeah, I would actually love to go to an American baseball game if I was there in a way that I wouldn't for any other sport, like golf, gridiron, whatever, hockey, ice hockey, wouldn't give a hoot. I would love to go to a baseball game in a real stadium at a real match and experience it. I would love to.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, with sports films in general. A sport is always just, you know, I don't get into gridiron. I don't get into American football that much. But yet I like films about American football.
I by and large don't. There's not many sports films, not that I've seen a lot because I tend not to watch them, but I don't know that there's any other sports film.
Yeah.
That engages me. I say the merger could have, if it was a better film and story, it didn't get there for me. It would have had a home ground advantage, literally.
Well, good work.
This film, and you know, when I give a film a 10, I've said to you in the past, and I think we've both said this, that a 10 film is something which is not just really good in its category, it kind of transcends.
Well,
this is a big Hollywood studio film of the 80s. It had quite a reasonable budget.
Yeah.
That nails it, not just as a good film, but really gives something back in terms of depth and emotion rather than like corny, easy sentiment that you often get in Hollywood films. And I still think
it is quite sentimental.
It's sentiment's an interesting word because you can say cheap sentiment, and I don't think this film is like that. I think the sentiment is about... that nostalgia. And I think it nails the emotions. I think sometimes
it does force you. I feel like it's forcing you to feel a little bit. When? Right? Like when Moonlight Graham talks about his regret
The small town doctor.
Yes.
What about it?
The music comes in, he's talking about it. Look, he's trying to make you feel.
If there's a weak point in the film.
Okay.
It actually is Burt Lancaster. He's a bit overmannered, and I would have loved to have seen James Stewart in that
when
part.
He found him and the mystery of finding him and everything, that was fine. But then it does ask you there to sort of feel emotional for what's happening and what he's saying and whatnot. And I didn't really feel it there.
I laugh at your moment. I think you're really reaching.
The dramatic effect of the girl falling off, and you get a feel for the daughter.
But that's a narrative device.
In terms of the daughter, though, she makes every decision in the movie.
No, she's a narrative device. She just moves the story along. She's just an external part of the device. I didn't feel like I meant to feel anything for her. She just made the story tick over.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think you're wrong.
No, I'm not wrong.
You're acting
like I've given this a 4 out of 10. I've given it an 8 out of 10.
You effectively have.
I've given this an 8 out of 10.
I think this is a boy's
movie. I actually really like this movie.
I think this not enough. I think this is a boy's film, and so I can imagine. And I'm not saying, I don't want to stereotype. I can imagine a lot of women potentially might not buy into the story because it is a boy and father story at its heart.
Yeah.
Unless they're particularly into baseball or other parts of the story. Mm. And I think the Annie character is a really great character.
You know,
what's that test where the female characters have their own concerns, not just all about the man?
Oh, the Bleschel
test. Yes. I think a character passes that, which again, in a major Hollywood film, maybe of the 80s.
In the 80s, is pretty damn good. Yeah, she's very good, actually. Yeah.
But I can imagine that, let's say, some women would have problems relating to this film. I think some people who might not want to engage in the magic of this kind of story, the Capra-esque nature of it, again, might not rate it very highly. But you, as Ricardo, you are wrong.
No, as an 8 out of 10.
And we are taking you down, man.
8 out of 10.
Yeah, not enough.
That is veering for me into near classic territory.
I would accept a 9 from you.
No, an 8 is good.
La, 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 I can't hear.
Okay, well, looks like we're going to have to agree to disagree.
La 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 la.
So that concludes our Sports Day episode.
Yay.
Oh, looks like you enjoyed one of them, at least.
That's right, I'm still thinking about sports.
Yeah, that's right. So next episode is our finale for season 3.
It is.
Which is quite amazing.
And we're going to do something a little bit different, a little bit special.
Yeah, we are going to do something different here. We're going to take a road trip to the Australian Podcast Awards from Melbourne to Sydney, and while doing so, review road movies.
Seems like a good idea in the workshop.
So we'll see how that goes. So the films we're going to be discussing, there's something very different in here because there's a short film in here, which is a road movie short film, which was 2011's Nullarbor, which is a short film that won many awards.
A short animated film.
Short animated film.
Which I've yet to see. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to do another film I haven't seen, unbelievably, which is 1991's Thelma and Louise. Probably one of the archetypical modern road movies.
That's right.
Are we going to go and drag for that?
Oh yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to revisit that. Actually, I've only seen it once. I think it was back in the 90s. So
I've yet to. I mean, everyone spoiled the ending, but I've yet to see it.
Oh really? You've never seen Thelma and Louise?
No, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes.
Okay. Well, then the next film we're going to be discussing is Sideways, which is the 2004 film.
And then we're going to end, as we plan to begin for this next episode, with an Australian road movie.
That's right.
1994's, I think, international hit, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. So there's two films we're going to have to drag up for.
That's right. But
I better start packing.
I actually quite like starting on the short Nullarbor. It kicks off proceedings for this road movie, for the epic finale of season 3. It's exciting.
This is quite an Australian thing for our overseas listeners, that getting in a car and going long distances is a particularly Australian thing that may happen in other countries like America, but you can just drive a long way. We'll be driving the equivalent of driving between, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 European countries.
That's right. So we're taking the trip from Melbourne to Sydney, which is a 9-hour drive.
Each way.
So you're going to hear some car sounds. It's going to be, we're going to be on the road.
And we realised the other day that you and I have, the longest we have spent in a car together is popping down to the shops to pick up pizza.
Pizza.
So this is going to be interesting.
Will there be a season 4?
You took the words out of my mouth. We may never speak to each other again. I might have to phone in my performances.
Well,
literally.
Thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you for all your support, and we'll see you next time.
On your sport.